Geneva office, was pastor in Hanover, in several parishes, then became associated with the general office. And when Dr. Hans Poleski resigned as editor of Lutheran World, he became the editor, and with the resignation of Dr. Lundquist, he became the acting executive director, and since then has been appointed the full-time executive director of the Lutheran World Federation. I'm sure many of you have read his articles in Lutheran World, particularly pertaining to his ecumenical interests. As executive director, he has, of course, visited major portions of the Lutheran Church in all the continents. He has been in the United States on a number of occasions, and we are deeply honored that he will address us today on the Lutheran World Federation. Dr. Schmidt-Klausen.
Mr. President, members of the faculty, students, friends, allow me to express my gratitude for your kind invitation and greeting to be a guest at Concordia Theological Seminary. Is an honor and a privilege indeed. The seminary has a worldwide reputation as a seat of learning and of sound Lutheran theology. Therefore, I followed your invitation with great joy. Allow me in this connection to extend to you on behalf of the Lutheran World Federation cordial greetings and good wishes. May the Lord bless this institution and may he also bless the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which again and again has given so marvelous examples of its dedication to the gospel of Christ Jesus. It has been suggested that during my presentation this morning I give an outline of the work and functions of the Lutheran World Federation. Of course, I can only sketch it very roughly in such a short time, but allow me to try so. And if anything becomes unclear, just interrupt me and ask, or perhaps we later on may have some opportunity for clarifying questions. What is the Lutheran World Federation? Well, speaking as a statistician, I should think one says it is an association of 73 different Lutheran churches with approximately 52 million individual members. The headquarters of the federation is in Geneva, Switzerland. The member churches of the LWF, as we abbreviate, of course, we abbreviate everything, so we also abbreviate the title of the Lutheran World Federation as LWF. The headquarters of this LWF is in Geneva, Switzerland, and the member churches serve in all continents. There are more than 200 languages which are spoken in various areas, but there is no uniformity of church government or constitution among the member churches. They are united only or predominantly, or whatever you would like to call it, they are united in a common doctrinal basis. The Federation was founded in 1947 in the old Swedish city of Lund in order to be the successor organization to the Lutheran World Convention. This convention started its life in 1923 in Eisenach, shortly after World War I, as a first attempt towards closer interchurch relations among the many Lutheran churches of the world. The Lutheran World Convention was founded after many years of careful preparation, both in North America and in Europe. One may describe this convention as the first result of a real movement towards Lutheran unity, and this character of a movement rather than of a status has since then been, I hope, preserved in the LWF. Today we find it almost impossible to understand that there was a time when the various Lutheran churches of the world lived in complete isolation from one another. There was, as I mentioned already, one tie which kept them as a family, their common confession of faith. But otherwise, they all lived as if the rest of the family did not exist at all.
They were almost completely tied up with their respective geographical or national or social environments. Their outlook was completely or strictly limited to their immediate neighborhood. They did not see clearly enough what it meant for them that the world into which their Lord had sent them was only one world, and that therefore there was only one common task for them, namely to proclaim the good news of the coming of the Redeemer to all mankind. 2 long centuries elapsed after the Reformation before the first Lutheran missionaries were sent out. It took another 150 years before the church's responsibility in the field of diaconia and social service was rediscovered. And only after World War I it became possible to draw the necessary conclusions out of this tragic situation and to have the Lutheran churches of the world, irrespective of nation or language or race or social system, cooperate. And the field of theology or mission or education, stewardship, service, worship, interconfessional research, and other fields. Well, of course, there are some relative excuses for this Lutheran isolationism of the past. One has to be fair. If one looks into history in order not to measure the past by our own standards, there were reasons of geography and language and culture which kept the churches apart from each other. And then there was the state church system, predominant in almost all of the Lutheran churches up to the beginning of the 19th century. One must not forget that in the beginning there were even good reasons for the Lutheran Church to agree of the state church system, of the intervention of Protestant princes and states in church affairs, because without this secular support, the Reformation might have failed in its historic sense. But in the long run, it turned out that the various states rather regarded the church as a sub-department of the respective state. The states were not in the least interested in any form of international church relations. On the contrary, they tried to transform the churches as far as possible into purely national institutions, serving no other purpose than that of the respective state or nation. A very striking example for the abusive character of state churchism is to be seen in the enforcement of the Prussian Union between Lutherans and Calvinists in 1817 and the following years. This union was not based upon any theological consensus. It was likewise not based upon any necessity of church life. It served exclusively the interests of the state of Prussia, which desired ideological unity after the Vienna Peace Treaty. Among its many subjects, many of them were new subjects to the Prussian state at that time, it is quite possible that the Prussian king would never have dared to consider such a drastic step if at that time there would have been something like an international Lutheran fellowship in whatever organized form. But even the confession of the Lutheran churches became a questionable achievement in a time where isolationism and particularism predominated. For the Lutheran confession of faith is something very universal, I should say very Catholic, just the opposite to particularism and isolationism. The Lutheran confession testifies to the fact that all mankind, without exception, is in Adam, as St. Paul says, Romans 5, under the fall. And it testifies to the fact that God's plan of salvation is even more universal than the universality of sin. He wants to save all mankind, that they all become new in Christ. The justification of fallen men for Christ's sake by faith alone is the one event that really matters for everybody, be he rich or poor, white or black, man or woman, young or old. This universality and Catholicity of God's justifying love is the center of the biblical message, as rediscovered by Martin Luther. This universality of the message of justification, however, becomes overshadowed or endangered or even crippled if isolationism or particularism of any sort prevents the church from testifying to that universality. The Lutheran confession of faith may lose even its relevance when such factors as I've just mentioned influence or even cripple the proclamation of the one true gospel. One of the main reasons for seeking and promoting international Lutheran cooperation and fellowship, therefore, has to be seen in the ardent desire to preserve and to strengthen the genuine teaching of the Reformation by thorough and considerate inter-church cooperation, predominantly in the field of theology. Now, the Commission on Theology plays a decisive role today within the framework of the Lutheran World Federation. All the branches of work of the LWF are related, in one way or the other, to the ongoing task of theology. They need to be perpetually reviewed and re-examined in the light of theological principles. When the churches formed their Lutheran World Federation, they did so primarily in order to reach, through theological cooperation, a growing degree of theological unanimity and clarity in all fields of their work. They expect and they hope that through this ongoing work of seeking theological clarity, the Lutheran confession of faith becomes again visible in its full universal relevance and meaningfulness. The Constitution of the Lutheran World Federation expresses this concern in two different places. In Article 2, it defines as condition for membership in the LWF the acceptance of the three ecumenical creeds and of the confessions of the Evangelical Lutheran Church, especially the Augsburg Confession and Luther's Small Catechism. This definition is called the doctrinal basis of the LWF. In Article 3, Paragraph 2, in its amended form, the Constitution lists under the functions of the LWF as the first one the following: to further a united witness before the world that the gospel of Jesus Christ is God's power for salvation. From this it becomes quite clear that acceptance of the confessions of the Lutheran Church is a prerequisite for membership in the LWF. But it also is clear that, on the other hand, full clarity and unanimity in all details of theology is not a prerequisite, but rather the goal which we hope to reach through joint theological efforts, just as we hope in this way to further a united or unanimous proclamation of the one true gospel into all parts of the world. From this again, it becomes clear that the obligation of the Lutheran World Federation to further a united witness of the gospel of Christ Jesus means an outreach far beyond the borderline of our Lutheran community of churches of today. In true obedience to the main purpose of the Reformation, namely to bring to all Christendom the pure gospel instead of the corrupted one, world Lutheranism of today must strive to communicate to the other Christian communities its understanding and confession of the truth as revealed in Christ Jesus. Here we see the very center of our ecumenical obligation, namely to see to it that the true and uncorrupted witness of the gospel becomes more and more manifest inside and outside our confessional borderline. Confessional Lutheranism, therefore, is by its very nature obliged towards theological dialogue and conversation with other Christian churches. If we see it that way, then it becomes clear why the Commission on Theology had to have a daughter commission which is concerned with this ecumenical dialogue. I'm referring here to the Commission on Interconfessional Research, which was established in 1957 in order to prepare the formation of an institute, a scientific institute, for theological research in the field of interconfessional relations. The fourth assembly of the LWF last summer in Helsinki voted the establishment of this institute, which will have its location in Strasbourg, at the border of France and Germany, and which will, provided we get the necessary financial support, which will deal with various fields of confessional study. The fields of study will be concerned with the Roman Catholic tradition, the Reformed, the Anglican, the Orthodox, and other traditions within Christendom. The purpose of these studies will be to understand better and more clearly what the other confessions really want to stand for and not what we suppose they stand for. And secondly, to interpret to them our own position in a clear and scholarly way. The method of work will include a journal, the editing and printing of relevant research books, research volumes, seminars for postgraduate students, theological conversations with scholars of other confessions, etc., etc. Of course, the results of this work are only material for our cooperating churches. They are in no way binding them. The Institute would have no power whatsoever to negotiate on behalf of the LWF or of its member churches or any of them. I believe that we have good reason to be confident that this work will be helpful not only to our Lutheran churches, but also to Christianity in general. I should like to remark in this connection that the Institute was able to provide the LWF with the three observers which we were invited to send to the Second Vatican Council. And I must report here that the experiences of the observers we had there have been very encouraging ones, especially insofar as they were able to get context into the Roman Catholic Church and theology, which we never were able to establish before. We have no reason to be over-optimistic as to the results of the Second Vatican Council. That is not yet closed. We shall have to wait. But on the other hand, we must be all, I think, very impressed by the flexibility and the spirit of reform, which is now in the Roman Catholic Church. I wouldn't have believed it 10 years ago that this monolithic church, that apparently monolithic church, would have such a council at all, and then in this council, such a discussion and such a virulent and heavy will, or clear will towards reform. And our observers have had quite a share in that discussion. And they were, of course, they had no official position there. They were not members of the council. Nobody was of the observer group. But nevertheless, they were invited in numerous groups by the council fathers to explain their position when there was anything critical where the Romans wanted theological advice from non-Roman Catholic churches. And I have the confidence that this contact will be maintained even towards the time after the council. So there is a possibility for getting better information, for getting better knowledge of the position of the partner in the dialogue, if you do it or try it in a thoroughgoing way. When I said earlier that the desire for theological clarity and unanimity has become the main motive and cause for the existence of the LWF, then I did not mean to say that it was the only one. There were and there still are other reasons for having worldwide Lutheran cooperation. These reasons are visibly reflected in the various branches of our work, namely in the commissions, for example, Commission on World Mission, Commission on World Service, Commission on Stewardship and Evangelism, on Worship and Spiritual Life, on Education. Then we have an LWF Broadcasting Service, Radio Voice of the Gospel. We have a Community Development Project, Liaison and Validation Service, a very long title indeed, but a very growing and very hopeful branch of our work. The work of the Commission on World Service grew out of the period of disaster and destruction after the two world wars, when there were people and churches in need. And it so happened that with the end of World War II, the series of catastrophical events had by no means come to an end. In this situation, two things were necessary. Firstly, a large operation to supply the hungry and the needy in the war-devastated areas with food and clothing. This had to be a help according to need and not to creed. Secondly, it was necessary to have an operation of inter-church aid, the purpose of which was, and still is, to enable the smaller Lutheran churches better to fulfill their obligation to preach the gospel and to administer the sacrament. This second operation is, of course, entirely different from the first one, theologically speaking. Relief and emergency aid are part of the diaconic function of churches and Christians over against all people. Interchurch aid, however, is part of the missionary task of the church and is, strictly speaking, a help according to creed and to need, of course, too. Both types of operations should not be mixed up one with another. The development in both areas of work has been very significant. In 1945, it was only the American and the Swedish Lutheran churches that were able to help at all, because they had rather been unshaken by the course of war events themselves. Later on, when Europe recovered, other churches like the Norwegian, the Danish, the Finnish, the German, and the Austrian churches joined their efforts with those of the American and Swedish churches. So gradually a large operation came into existence based in both directions, to the receiving end and to the giving end, on multilateral arrangements. Our most significant types of relief operations today are located in Jordan, where there are still 800,000 Arab refugees out of Palestine, of the Israel part of Palestine. They still live there in most deplorable conditions. Then the second area is Hong Kong, where we have almost 1.5 million Chinese refugees living. The third very important area is the Bengal refugee area south of Calcutta, that came into existence after the partition of the former British India into Pakistan and the Indian Republic. There are still 12 million refugees in India, approximately, which have not yet settled down. It's incredible, but it's true. And the fourth area, of course, is war-stricken Algeria. These are the main areas of relief and emergency programs. Our permanent effort has been not only to supply food and clothing and housing, but also to develop, on a growing scale, a self-help program. In the field of interchurch aid, our most important areas of concern are the minority churches in Europe and Latin America, and the mission churches in Asia, Oceania, and Africa. One of the fundamental principles is to use this type of help to assist the churches at points of vital strategic interest, if at all possible. Further, it has to be observed that a second principle is of vital concern in this field of work, namely to keep the receiving church as autonomous and as self-supporting as possible. Interchurch aid must never be misused to make the receiving church dependent, or to develop on the giving side a kind of paternalism. Oh, we know that. Therefore, we have seen it very often happen in our own churches. Therefore, experience has led us to the conclusion that multilateral interchurch aid programs are much more to be preferred, which are then channeled through our international agencies, than bilateral arrangements between the respective donor on the one end and the receiver on the other. This latter practice seems to be less endangered by Parkinson's law. I admit that. It seems to foster direct contacts from church to church. But if you look into the core of the matter, you will find that this practice of direct bilateral health arrangements has many more weak points than our present practice. The bilateral type of help may at least encourage competition and rivalry among the receivers. It may also encourage paternalism and empire building among the givers. I do not say that this must be so by necessity, but our observations have fairly often proved that this is at least a temptation. So therefore we follow the other practice, which seems to be more reasonable, more just, and more economic at the same time. But this, of course, is a matter to be disputed. You will have noticed that when I mentioned the areas of interchurch aid, I also included the areas of mission churches. This is important in order to understand the nature of operation of our Commission on World Mission. Some people have suspected that this commission might play the same role within the LWF as the Congregatio de Propaganda Fide in the Roman Catholic sense. But this is absolutely unfounded. The Lutheran World Federation does not supervise or centralize or guide the work of the various missions. It simply coordinates the efforts to strengthen the younger churches and the mission fields through a carefully balanced inter-church aid program, which the churches themselves carry out into effect. Again, the same principles as mentioned before. We attempt to pool our resources together and by such multilateral character of the aid, support the younger churches in such a way that their autonomy too is fully respected and that they become not dependent upon one particular donor. We believe that this is good stewardship and responsible help. In connection with the work of World Mission, I should like to mention that also this commission has a daughter. The Lutheran World Federation's broadcasting service, Radio Voice of the Gospel. This system of powerful shortwave transmitters is located in Addis Abeba. It has an international staff of about 60 people located there and about a dozen regional or area studios in West Africa, East Africa, South Africa, Madagascar, Near East, India, Indonesia, and so on. Each day, many hours of religious and educational programs are broadcasted into these regions since February last year. So far, I think in more than a dozen languages, but hopefully more in the future. Our service is in close cooperation with the great operation of the Lutheran Hour and with other Christian broadcasting enterprises. I'm not going to describe in detail the other branches of our work, for example, the work of the study commission or the channeling of development aid projects, etc. This would supersede our time, this would consume too much of our time. All the studies of the study commissions, let me say this in a summarizing way, are intended to serve particular needs of our member churches in the field, where they need help. They all have to learn from each other, evaluate each other's different experiences, and thus do their own work better and more effective. Let me, before I conclude my remarks, tell you a little bit about the fourth assembly, which took place last summer in Helsinki, Finland. The General Assembly, Lutheran World Federation is to be convened every 5 or now 6 years. Here the delegates of our member churches come together for about 2 weeks in order to review the work of the past period and in order to plan policy and work for the coming 6 years. You may be assured that the agenda was pretty loaded this time. Much too loaded, I should think. And in addition to that, the Finns had their warmest summer since decades. Unexpectedly warm. So we rather got into a sauna of a great, great magnitude in the autumn. In spite of all these and many other difficulties, the assembly got along fine. It did not only clear the questions of immediate structure and policy of its work for the next year, it also took upon itself to handle a very difficult, very delicate theological theme. We all believe that it is not enough when the delegates from all over the world talk only policy and structure. They have a much more important task to fulfill when they come together. They have to encourage each other in the faith. And they have to see to it that the proclamation of that faith is relevant and meaningful to the world of today. For also today, also in our affluent society, with all its progress and success, fallen men need God's power for salvation. This was the reason why the Helsinki Assembly discussed the central theme of the Reformation, namely justification of the sinner by faith alone. The intention was not to revive this dogma, for neither is this necessary, nor is an assembly of the Lutheran World Federation too empowered to develop new doctrine. The Lutheran World Federation's assembly is no council, by no means. The assembly wanted rather to try to encourage its member churches to make better use of this center of our message, to make it more relevant, more meaningful to our world by applying it to the terminology of our age. And that has to be done substantially. I believe that the attempt as such was a success. This 6-year period of joint preparation by the Commission on Theology and in the member churches was a good and a healthy experience as such. It has revealed many of our shortcomings and failures in our proclamation of the gospel, and it has given us new hopes and new insights. The regrettable fact that the result of the discussion in Helsinki, as contained in that famous document 75, could not be fully approved. This fact must not be taken too seriously. The shortness of time and some unclarity about the intended role of the document, as well as about the character of the assembly, prevented the adoption. I told you already that some of the members of the assembly thought rather highly of the assembly in terms of a council, and so they became very infuriated when that report, it was rather, was going to be accepted. They thought it was a new dogma, and there they had quite a number of reservations. I would have had those too. It will be revised and shall be published after the Commission on Theology shall have slightly revised some passages of the document in light of the last plenary discussion. But even if there would have been no document at all, the matter as such would have lost nothing of its striking importance. It was, please allow me to say so, I think it really was courageous by the Executive Committee of the LWS and by the member churches to venture to take upon themselves to study such a subject and to discuss publicly how to preach justification of the sinner in a more relevant and more convincing way. It has struck many people, for example from the secular press, that the Federation had even included the risk of hurting its own prestige by publicly revealing the sharp differences of methodological opinion on this matter. But to the same people, same press people, for example, I have observed them very closely, to the same press people it became likewise evident that the Lutheran doctrine of justification is not a medieval showpiece out of an archaeological museum, but that it is relevant and meaningful for men even in the space age. And I think that's a good thing to know. Another important matter for the Assembly has been the attempt to define the Federation's role over against its member churches and also over against the ecumenical movement. The question put forward in Assembly Document Number 4 as to the so-called nature of the Lutheran World Federation was answered by one of the main lecturers, by an American, Professor E. Clifford Nelson from Luther Theological Seminary in St. Paul. And it was also answered by amendments to the Constitution. The answer given by the Assembly in these two different ways distinguishes very clearly between the present legal status of the Federation and the theological and spiritual aims or goal on the other. Legally speaking, the Lutheran World Federation is a federation, a free association, not one legal centralized body. Its member churches have autonomy. They are not just subsections which depend on the central agency. It would be neither possible nor desirable to transfer the Federation or transform the Federation into one centralized church body on world level. The Assembly stated this very clearly and rejected all other interpretations. But the Assembly did not only reject false interpretation on the legal character of the LWF, it also expressed in a positive way the true theological and ecclesiological functions and aims of the Lutheran World Federation. This is to say that the Assembly expressed what it would hope that the Federation ultimately ought to become, namely a worldwide fellowship of the Word and Sacrament, according to Augustana 7. The Assembly thinks of the LWS as of a process, a worldwide process of through which the Lutheran churches grow together in order to become more effective instruments of their Lord. The deeper they grow into unity of doctrine and spirit, the better they will be able to manifest the will of God to all mankind. This, however, requires an ongoing effort among the member churches. Growing doctrinal unity among Lutherans will, on the other hand, foster the ecumenical dialogue with other Christians. This is not always properly understood. Many people believe that loyalty to the confession of the church means an obstacle to unity. Some critical voices have been raised recently in ecumenical circles against the so-called threats of world confessionalism. They seem to believe that the main goal of the ecumenical movement will be achieved at the same moment where some worldwide gigantic organizational merger of the various church bodies has been set up. Local councils, regional councils, national councils, and then finally some kind of Christian interconfessional United Nations or so. Well, there are some people who think seriously about this kind of pattern. But what purpose should such gigantic machinery serve? And would the real reasons for separation among Christians, would they be removed by such organizational pattern and such organizational organic unity? Would they not, these reasons for separation, would they not continue to exist under the surface of this gigantic pattern? God beware, this would be horrible. I believe that Lutherans have to make a most important contribution to the ecumenical dialogue, and I am also convinced that they are under obligation to make it, lest they deny the heritage of the Reformation. What is this Lutheran contribution? To reaffirm again and again that the true unity of the church is primarily a problem of faith and witness and doctrine, and that it is not primarily a problem of organization or clever politics. Some people say Lutherans are dreaming in a most utopian fashion when they believe that theological consensus is possible or is the proper way towards church unity. I would answer that church history proves the opposite, namely that only such unions or such solutions survived and became relevant for many centuries, the basis of which was a thoroughgoing theological consensus. Take, for example, Chalcedon, or take the formula of Concord. This formula is one of the basic documents, to my mind, of the ecumenical movement. If one thinks of a proper method for ecumenical encounter, one cannot bypass this important document. Two one-sided interpretations of the Lutheran position were rejected, the Philippist and the Gnesio Lutheran. They were superseded by a reaffirmation of Luther's original reformatory work. Both emphases were present in that original position. The formula has tried to bring them together after they were polemically separated. It did not do so by way of compromise, but by restating the initial reformatory point of departure. We should study the formula also under this methodological aspect, and we would soon discover what a marvelous model it offered for sincere ecumenical dialogue, which wants to be taken seriously. Doing so, we might also discover that this model of the formula of concord could move us and would move us into a thoroughgoing development toward new concord. Of course, there are many other prerequisites necessary for a proper ecumenical dialogue. Readiness to listen and to learn. Readiness to acknowledge the truth wherever it may be spelled out. Readiness to obey the eighth commandment. And to abandon all wrong prejudices and talk about other Christians. But the most important prerequisite for the ecumenical dialogue has always been and shall always be our willingness to serve God's purposes in the first instance, and let our human ends stay in the second row. If it is His will that be done on earth as in heaven, let us never try to make Him serve our ends, not even in the ecumenical context. But of course, the ecumenical dimension is only one dimension of the Lutheran World Federation. There are others besides it which are as important and meaningful. Basically, the Lutheran World Federation is a family of churches. As in every other family, the members are not alike. Each has its own personality, yet they are all tied together by one common tie, their common origin and blood. In the case of the LWF, I think the confession is that tie. And like in every other family, there is giving and taking from everyone to everyone. Each member enriches the other with its gifts and talents, and it likewise receives from the other. For they all are not owners of their gifts and talents. They are stewards of God. It is His property which they are privileged to administer and to use. And like in every other family, there are shortcomings and failures and weaknesses among the members of the Lutheran World Federation. But the more they grow together, and basically, I told you, the LWF is a process of growing. The more they learn to make joint use of the grace of God, the more they will learn to avoid bad experiences and fulfill their task, which together they may be able to render in a more convincing and satisfactory way than if they all would have stayed alone. So you will understand why my colleagues and I are glad to serve the LWF, and we hope and pray that, God permitting, one day the ties will also be closer between the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, and the Lutheran World Federation. Thank you very much.
Thousand of you were here on our faculty or on campus for a long time, you would know that we are very economic in our applause, and I think this is a special tribute to you and the work that you are doing, and of course the LWF. We have a few moments for a few questions, say about 5 minutes. Those of you who have one that you would like to ask, we can entertain a few of these if you please. Yes, sir, please.
Is there any relations that are communicating between the Lutheran World Federation and the World Council of Churches?
Yes, there is. We are on the same campus. But there is. But besides this, there are only personal relationships, but there is no organizational relationship. Let's say that in that way that the LWF is, so to say, part of the World Council or has any kind of other constitutional or organizational relationship. As far as possible, we work together, for example, in the field of world service, interchurch, emergency programs, and so on. And, of course, there is a connection between our member churches, which are members of the World Council, through this project. But a direct organizational relationship does not exist.
Please.
Well, we have a
appointed three of them upon the request of the secretariat of Cardinal Bear. This is the famous secretariat for promoting Christian unity. And we had also invited the Roman Catholic Church to send, for the first time, observers to the LWF Assembly in Helsinki, and they had come. Observers are strictly limited in their prerogatives. They have to observe and to confidentially report.